ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's hard to get your loved ones to change their habits, let alone change world history. But that's exactly what happened with apartheid.
And a demonstrator has run right through the play.
Australians and millions of others took a stand and helped to bring the racist South African regime to its knees. I'm Sesonke Msimang, and join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
We seem to start every health report talking about your cooking and nutrition choices. I'm getting a bit, shirty about this.
It's interesting because you're the one who chooses what we talk about. You're trying to imply it's me, Norman Swan.
We're a team. Don't shirk responsibility. We're a team about this. So let's come clean. Today we're going to be talking about ultra-processed foods and a really interesting study which relates it to children's behaviour, which is what a lot of people think has been really controversial. But that's just one of the topics that we're going to be talking about today on the Health Report.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
Also on the show, potentially some big changes for testing when it comes to sexually transmitted infections like syphilis, gonorrhea and chlamydia. People might be waiting days for their results, but there could be a quicker test that is portable on the way.
Yeah, it's been portable testing for a while, but this should be a good innovation. And in women's health, they're walking the talk in terms of how you define health when it comes to women's health. And it should be broad, and this research emphasises how broad it should be.
Yes, and the line is beyond the bikini line. So I think this is going to be an eye-opening interview for a lot of people. In the news, there is a study that has been published in JAMA Network Open on smoking, quitting smoking and how you can do it. And it's quite interesting because they've compared psilocybin.
The active ingredient, or one of the active ingredients in magic mushrooms.
So they've compared psilocybin, which is the psychedelic, as you say, to nicotine replacement therapy. They've got about 82 people and they've randomised them into two separate groups. One group received a high single dose of psilocybin in a controlled environment.
Yeah, they lay back on a couch and had a mask on and listened to some music. Very similar to what you would do in psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy for depression, except there wasn't a psychotherapy closely associated with his experience, but we'll come back to that later.
Well, there was cognitive behavioural therapy, so I was just about to say that. Both groups in this intervention had exposure to cognitive behavioural therapy over the time.
Aimed at smoking cessation.
Yes, correct. Very targeted cognitive behavioural therapy. The other group didn't have psilocybin. They had nicotine replacement therapy in the form of patches. And what they've done is they've compared the two groups at 6 months and said how effective are both of these therapies with the cognitive behavioural therapy alongside them at helping people quit smoking.
And the psychedelic was more effective.
It was more effective, considerably.
So now we need to put in the caveats here.
Yes, so I was going to do that too. Go on.
I can be the caveat person. You can be the good news person. Sort of Scottish accent goes with the downer. You can be the upper.
Okay.
So they were smoking 15 a day on average. They'd had 6 quit attempts on average. They were psychologically healthy when they went in, so they didn't have any what they call mental health comorbidities is the technical term for that. And they measured abstinence as well as smoking fewer cigarettes per day. And you've got to watch that in smoking. You really do need to head for abstinence, even though you accept failures along the way, because the most dangerous cigarettes are the first 10. So just cutting down to just, say, 1, 2, 3, or 4 cigarettes a day can still be quite toxic for you. So you've really got to give them up. Nobody knows why the first 10 are the worst 10, but that low dose is not good for you. But the big caveat here was it's very hard to do a double-blind study with this because, first of all...
Well, this was unblinded. They admit that it was unblinded. So there's that huge thing where you take a medication and there's expectation.
And it was a pilot study. But it's testing the idea that psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin, and perhaps others, first of all, when you look at large groups of people taking psychedelics, they seem to have lower smoking rates. But that could well be because they can afford to take these drugs. There may be different health attitudes. It's not necessarily the psychedelic that's associated with the non-smoking. But there are suggestions from the way the messengers work in the brain that the psychedelics are affecting the neurochemicals that are involved in addiction. So it needs a bigger trial that's better conducted, but it's interesting.
It is interesting, and I would just say to anyone who is potentially quitting smoking that we do have a lot of options available to us, including oral options, which are often more effective than just single nicotine replacement therapy. I would have loved to have seen this compared to perhaps an oral option like varenicline is an agent that we use. But yeah, I think it's interesting how we got to psilocybin in this space. I always ponder, how did we get here?
They just had this idea that psychedelics have this perhaps anti-addictive effect, and they're in a population basis, as I said before, it's associated with lower smoking rates, but that may be nothing to do with the psychedelic.
And how do you get oral psilocybin in a big dose? Like, you know, this is difficult to actually put into practice in the community. I'm thinking of the practical real-world implications.
You are.
There's good news, I would say, in the cancer world.
Oh, you can say this one then.
Yes, I can. Well, because it's to do with women and cancer outcomes led by South Australian researchers, which included over 20,000 patients.
So just to explain, these were trials that were testing drugs against what are called solid tumours. So these are things like lung cancer, thyroid cancer, cancer of the bladder and so on, in people who had advanced cancer, which had often spread to other organs. So often new drugs are tested on advanced cancers before you get down to earlier in the treatment regime. But often they don't split the results by gender. And we've talked about that a lot on the Health Report, is that, first of all, research tends to be more male-oriented. But what happens when you split it out by gender?
Well, interestingly, what this study found is that women had a 21% lower risk of death. The female participants had a lower risk of death and a 16% lower risk of disease progression. But they did have a higher risk of side effects and quite a lot higher. But the researchers are suggesting that perhaps gender could be an independent prognostic indicator when it comes to cancer.
Yep. And so this is great news. There's no easy answer to this question. It could be hormonal. It could be that women's immune systems work a bit differently because some of the drugs affected the immune system, although interestingly, they had slightly different outcomes. But overall, it was good news, and it just shows you cannot generalise between men and women. And in this case, the news is good for women.
It is, and I think it's probably too soon. There's been a lot of discussion about the paper, and it's probably too soon to use gender as a prognostic indicator alone in a widespread manner, because we don't have a breakdown on, you know, you mentioned solid tumours. There's not a clear breakdown on which tumours and where you can potentially use gender as the prognostic indicator. So still probably more to know in the area.
Yeah. It might make a difference down the line where you have advanced cancer and it's a line ball decision about whether or not you continue. And the oncologist might say, well, look, you're a woman. On balance, you might do better and might be worth trying.
Yeah, wow, that might be where we're headed.
It might be.
That's where I might have an advantage over you, Norman.
Exactly. I'm feeling
you're
I'm
meant
feeling
to
it.
Say there's many places, Priya, where you have an advantage, but no.
There's many places, Priya, that yeah. you have an advantage.
In the news, people might remember this story from last year.
Rosie has undergone several surgeries, immunotherapy and targeted anti-cancer therapy. Unfortunately, while it has extended her life, the cancer continues to grow. And so Paul took matters into his own hands to find a treatment that targets her specific genetic mutation, which is known to be implicated in unfettered cell growth.
Because if I didn't try, I'd know that I hadn't tried everything, essentially.
This was an incredibly impactful story that we had on last year about a man and his dog.
Yes, Rosie's the dog, Paul is the man, and people might recall that Shelby Trainer, our producer, did a story about Paul's dog, Rosie, being diagnosed with cancer. Paul used ChatGPT to come up with a plan of attack to manage Rosie's cancer, ended up going to the University of New South Wales, and ended up having Rosie's cancer's genome sequenced and therefore developing targeted therapies.
That's right. It has to be said that Paul, this is not just any Paul. This is Paul, who is a data person himself and was able to afford the genomics, I think, which will cost him about $3,000. But then they collaborated with people at the University of New South Wales, but also overseas, and they developed an mRNA vaccine. Don't tell RFK Jr. that they developed an mRNA cancer vaccine. and gave it to the dog, and the dog has had a the dog only had a little while to live, and the dog is still living now. The tumour hasn't disappeared totally, but it has regressed in a major way.
It is a fascinating story, and you heard about it first on the Health Report, and now it is hitting headlines across the world.
Elon Musk has even bought into it. It's just a dog and her owner doing well. So it's a heartwarming story.
It's a good news story on the Health Report, which you're listening to on ABC Radio National.
You're always going on at me, Priya, about, you know, how I was trained in the ancient days in the pre-antibiotic era, you know, when we... But in the olden days, there was this idea going around, which is still around a little bit, is that diet and hyperactivity went together. And there was a notion that sugar hits were related to hyperactivity. It was really before ADHD became a big thing. They used to talk about hyperactivity in kids. There was a thing called the Feingold diet, which restricted sugar and food colorings in children and claimed huge benefits in behavior. But when the Feingold diet was properly tested, they didn't actually get results that justified the diet. And there's not really, with ADHD, much indication that diet has an effect one way or the other, or there are people who would argue that uphill and down dale, but there really isn't a lot of evidence. However, the idea hasn't gone away. And there's been a fascinating study of ultra-processed foods and children's behaviour. Really, what we're talking about are foods which don't look like foods often. They are highly processed. They often are high in sugar, high in salt. They have colorings in them. It's elsewhere. We largely know what we're talking about when we talk about ultra-processed foods. And they looked at the ultra-processed foods in childhood, around about the age of 3, and compared it to behaviors at the age of 5. It's an interesting study. It's a big study done in Canada. And one of the researchers was Cassetta Milliku, who is in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Toronto.
This study comes from the child cohort study, which is one of Canada's largest and most detailed pregnancy cohorts.
Just to explain, when you talk about a cohort study, this isn't a randomized trial. This is you pick up a group of kids from birth and you follow them through life, measuring as much as possible in their lives to see how you can compare what happens to these children to the influences in their lives.
Absolutely. That's 100% correct. In this cohort, we have been following thousands of children from pregnancy and onwards. Now these children are almost 16 years of age, and we have collected on them data on diet, environmental exposures, family and socioeconomic factors, and a range of health outcomes. So particularly in this study, we included over 2,000 children, which allowed us to examine how early life diet relates to later behavioral development.
What were the behavioral outcomes you were looking at?
And in our study, we captured 3 main domains, what we call internalizing behaviors, which are things like anxiety or withdrawal, externalizing behaviors like hyperactivity or aggression, and the total score, which reflects overall behavior challenges and sleep quality.
And what did you find?
Well, we found that children who consumed more ultra-processed food at the age of 3, they tended to have higher behavioral and emotional problem scores by the age of 5. We also modeled what happens if some of those ultra-processed foods were replaced with minimally processed foods, things like fruit, vegetables, or home-prepared meals. We saw that this change was associated with better behavioral scores.
And which behavioral scores were most pronounced?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. We actually found associations with all behaviors, but the internalizing one, so more the anxiety, the withdrawal symptoms, that was more strongly associated with ultra-processed food consumption.
So what you're saying here is there's an association between an ultra-processed food diet at the age of 3 predicting certain behaviors at the age of 5. Have you gone on to behaviors later on?
Our next goal is to look if this association persists later on in children and actually linked with the trajectories of behavioral development.
Now, this area has not had a good history. You've had Feingold diet for ADHD, which was related to sugar and food colouring and been shown to be highly dubious. So if this is true, what is it about ultra-processed foods that could be having this influence?
Well, our study is just observational in design. And we cannot say that ultra-processed food directly cause behavioral problems, but there are some mechanisms that we speculate around. Firstly, ultra-processed foods, they tend to displace foods that are rich in nutrients that are important for brain development, and diets that are low in fiber, vitamins, minerals, and health effects. Nutrients such as iron, zinc, folate, vitamin B12, vitamin D, and omega-3 fatty acids, they have all been implicated in brain and behavioral health.
So you're postulating a relative deficiency in those nutrients because the ultra-processed diet has replaced it.
Exactly. But there might be more other potential mechanisms. So we know about the gut-brain axis connection, and ultra-processed foods may also influence the gut microbiome. Also, potentially the chronic low-grade inflammation may be also part of the pathway. And there is research that shows that ultra-processed foods may promote inflammatory responses, and inflammation has been related earlier with mental and behavioral outcomes.
Now, when you've got an association, it's not cause and effect, but one of the things that gets you closer to cause and effect is dose effect. In this cohort, the more ultra-processed foods, the more the behavioral problem?
Indeed, we did find that the more the ultra-processed foods, more behavioral problems.
Families with high consumption of ultra-processed foods are not the same as families where there's a lot of minimally processed foods. You've got to have time, you've got to have money. You're going to tell me that you statistically adjusted for all that, but is it possible really to statistically adjust for those variables to say that it's the ultra-processed foods and not the complex lives that people may have with relative disadvantage, for example?
We indeed adjusted for many potential variables that can influence both the diet and behavior. It's interesting that we also had another publication where we try to understand the broader determinants on why some children consume more ultra-processed foods than others. And what we found is it's much broader. There were other variables, including the accessibility to job to parents, how far, how long do they need to commute, accessibility to fresh fruit and veggies market. Income itself did not appear as a significant variable, but it was the combination of a maternal-paternal diet, accessibility to jobs, accessibility to farmers market that pushes us more into the societal, like the food environment around us, where we're located and how accessible are these ultra-processed foods to us.
So if you've got a long commute, you're coming home tired and it's late, the easiest thing is to dip into the supermarket and buy something off the shelf.
Which are the easiest things to buy, right? That's why we really need to think about policies, how to really start and implement changes that will be easy but also meaningful for families.
Dr. Kizeta Miliku, who's in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Toronto.
I think it's difficult, this whole feeding children business, Norman, as a mum of two younger children. I think it's already so muddy and grey out there. This is great stuff to know, but I think, you know, everyone's trying. And often ultra-processed foods, Norman, are classified as like a yogurt or bread, things that are part of our everyday life. So I think, you know, don't feel guilty from this, but it's just extra information for your toolbox.
And as Cosetta said, the variables here are, for example, how far you've got to commute each day, and you're rushing home, you're feeling guilty, you've got dinner to make, and you go into the supermarket and you buy something that's going to be quick and convenient.
Yes, you've got to live and you've got a lot of stuff to fit in. But there are some, I think, ultra-processed foods that are just part of our life, and there are things you can do, like look at the salt intake of them and all these things. But some of them are just going to be there. I'm going to eat toast with tomato on it and salt and pepper. Are you?
How do you know I like that?
Do you like that?
Yeah, I usually have anchovies on top instead of the salt.
Oh, yum. White or normal? This has become a cooking show.
Normal.
Well, oh, there you go. We can be friends, Norman.
Yeah, well, don't go too far.
Okay.
You're with the Friendly Health Report here on ABC Radio National.
The next story is about women's health, and the spotlight often gets put on conditions like endometriosis, perimenopause, menopause, and rightly so. This is, you know, women's health has been dismissed for a very long time, under-researched, underfunded, and it's great that it's getting any attention at all and funding, and finally some momentum is being gained. But what's interesting is a study suggesting that the top issues for women are in fact not the things that we might all think about, and that women actually want attention and funding and resources on very different things. I spoke to lead author of the study, Dr. Sarah Holton, who's a senior research fellow at Monash University.
So the study had three sort of main components. So first of all, we did an online survey with women and girls who were living in all parts of Australia to see what they thought, which health conditions they were most concerned about or they needed information about or they thought needed more support. We also did a review of current research funding and research and media to see which conditions were being spoken about and which were getting most support. And then we also did some interviews with experts in the women's health field. So they were, you know, academics, healthcare providers, policy people, those sorts of things.
And in terms of the group that you surveyed, Australian women and girls, was it a diverse group in terms of where they live, ethnic diversity, age diversity?
Yes. We tried to really get a diverse sample. So so sometimes if we were, you know, sort of lacking a particular group, then we sort of emphasize our recruitment efforts in those areas. So we had a really nice spread of women from and girls who are aged 16 years and over from all parts of Australia. So not just living in the capital cities, but also living in some regional areas. And we had a nice diverse of women and girls with different sexual orientations, different cultural backgrounds. Yeah, so it was a really good mix.
So it can be applied generally to the population.
Yes, exactly.
So what did you find then, Sarah, in terms of what the top health concerns are for women and girls in Australia? What did you find?
It was really interesting because I think one of the reasons we really thought it was important to do this study was for a long time we sort of tended to think that women are the same as men and women's health has sort of been, you know, wrapped up in men's health. And there's always sort of been this sort of one size fits all approach to health conditions. You know, for example, like heart disease, we used to think that women's symptoms and experiences are exactly the same as men, but we now know that women are affected by certain conditions differently or are more likely to have certain conditions. So it was really interesting to find that most of the focus and research funding, the media and everything has really been focused on women's sexual and reproductive health. But as one participant told us, you know, we really need to go beyond the bikini line. And in fact, the areas that when we surveyed women and girls, the conditions that they were most concerned about and things that they were most concerned about were violence, so things like domestic violence, mental health conditions, endometriosis, homelessness, and a lot of chronic health conditions that really affect women differently or disproportionately to men. So they were things like fibromyalgia or heart disease.
Yeah, so very interesting. So the things, I think, you know, there's been a real shift in the women's health space and media attention and research, and rightly so, because it's been so underfunded and under-researched. But this suggests that the things that are getting the headlines at the moment are not necessarily what a lot of women and girls are really worried about, violence and homelessness.
Exactly. And like the women that we spoke to and the girls we spoke to, they said it was really great that, you know, some of these health conditions like menopause and endometriosis and, you know, are starting to get more attention. And they thought that was really important because, you know, they had often struggled to get their symptoms addressed, and they'd also watch family members like their daughters and sisters have the same experience. But they said that they also thought that we needed more focus on other conditions that affect women. And that was, you know, women's health does matter and all conditions are important.
Did things differ according to age? So I know you looked at younger women, then middle-aged, then older. So can you just talk us through how the priorities differed according to the age groups?
Yes. So they did differ slightly. And not surprisingly, they tended to reflect the things that are most relevant to women at certain points in their life. So, you know, for younger women, even though overall women were concerned about, you know, mental health and violence and things like that, they also differed a little bit in terms of their age. Younger women tended to be a bit more focused on things like abortion or pregnancy, whereas women in that sort of middle age group were sort of focused more on things like menopause, not surprisingly, and older women were really concerned about things like dementia and homelessness and things like that.
And did things differ according to geographical location? So are women and girls in regional and remote areas worried about the same stuff as women living in cities?
The conditions that they were concerned about was very similar across metropolitan and regional and rural areas. But the thing that really differed in terms of those women living in those different areas was that women who were living in regional and rural areas of Australia really said it was often really difficult for them to access gender responsive healthcare. And, you know, if they were living in a small town, it might be that, you know, there's only one GP and they know that GP socially, or that GP's a man and they would prefer a female healthcare provider. So they really spoke about those sort of access sort of differences and also affordability of accessing affordable healthcare as well.
It feels like we're just starting to scratch the surface when it comes to women's health. And, you know, I think your study has highlighted that perhaps the lens is really on periods and menopause and endometriosis, but there are actually other things that really need addressing. How do we pivot, Sarah? How do we harness the current momentum to actually get funding, research, media attention to these silent issues, as you've called it, these silent issues that are affecting a lot of women and girls?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's great that we're getting to get this sort of, you know, increasing awareness of women's health, and it's great that the government's starting to provide some more funding and support for conditions like menopause and endometriosis, but we really, really need more research funding. And I think the other thing that's really important and that was highlighted in our research was that women who've got lived experience of a condition really need to be included in any research or program design about the conditions that affect them, so that we are addressing women's needs and making sure that the healthcare that they're trying to access is really suited to them and what they need.
Do we know, Sarah, or do we have a sense of what women and girls want when it comes to these silent issues? So you've raised violence, homelessness.
Yes.
Do people want more discussion, more action, more resources? Do we know what it is that will actually turn the dial for the people who actually need it?
The survey obviously had, you know, we often in surveys you have a lot of fixed response questions, but we also provided space at the end of the survey for women to write free text responses. And over a third of the women and girls who responded to the survey wrote a free text response, which is amazing.
Wow.
Because it doesn't often happen. People are, you know, usually just
they're exhausted.
They want to go. Yeah. But they like, and the things that they were telling us about were that they really want gender responsive, affordable healthcare. They, you know, they're saying, you know, healthcare shouldn't be a postcode lottery. And they said that they really wanted healthcare providers and women and men, basically people, everyone, to have more awareness and education about the conditions which affect women. And they also highlighted the need for more research and the inclusion of, as I mentioned before, having, you know, women in that research who have lived experience, so that, you know, they can get the care that they want.
I love that line, actually, that you mentioned, that women's health needs to look beyond the bikini line. And it's not to say what's within the bikini line is not important, because that has been dismissed and underfunded and under researched for so long. But we must broaden our understanding, and perhaps it's been too narrow and women are kind of waiting for the momentum to bring attention to these other issues.
Exactly. And I think the other sort of, one of the really surprising findings for me as a researcher was that such a small proportion of research funding was for women's health, you know, projects about and studies about women's health. And most of that was for women's reproductive and sexual health. And unfortunately, the funding that is available in Australia for research funding about, you know, the proportion that was allocated to women's health is really similar to other countries, the US, UK, Canada. So, you know, it's not that we're doing anything different in Australia to, you know, the rest of the world, but I think it's just really emphasises that, yes, we do need a sort of more holistic perspective of women's health.
Dr. Sarah Holton is a Senior Research Fellow at Monash University. So beyond the bikini line, that's the takeaway, and I love that because it's catchy, but it's also effective. And yes, we absolutely need the spotlight on the reproductive issues, as Sarah says, but gosh, there's so much more to this.
There is indeed. On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. So I'm really interested in this next story because it's about almost like tabletop testing, where you can do it before your eyes to do with sexually transmissible infections. Now, correct me, I thought that there already was quite a lot of tabletop testing available that you could actually, if you wanted to do cholesterol, hemoglobin and that sort of thing on your tabletop No.
Well, there are certainly things that are sold at pharmacies for point of care testing is what we call it, that you can actually do the test and attain the result. But day to day in general practice, I'm doing a pathology slip and getting the patient to ideally go and see the phlebotomist, get their blood drawn, it goes to the lab and gets analysed for accurate, reliable results for things like cholesterol and the rest. This story is about testing for sexually transmitted infections and specifically gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, and herpes simplex virus, really common sexually transmitted infections. And we've covered syphilis, Norman, quite recently on the Health Report because we've seen escalating rates of it in the community and changes to the pregnancy testing guidelines because there's so much of it circulating. This is a test that can look at several sexually transmitted infections, give you a quick result, and it relies on that CRISPR technology that people would have heard about again on the Health Report.
Gene editing.
Yeah. This is using it for something different. It's fascinating. It could revolutionise care in Australia, particularly for regional and remote communities. The person I spoke to is Dr. Shivani Pasricha, who's laboratory head at the Doherty Institute.
CRISPR technology is typically used for gene editing. And in the context of diagnostics, why it's so powerful is it only switches on if a very specific code is present in your sample. So for a clinical sample that might be positive for a certain STI, the CRISPR technology is made of two components. And the first component goes along searching for a very specific barcode on the pathogen DNA or RNA and binds tightly. And only once it's bound tightly does the second component, the enzyme, switch on. And then the enzyme's role is to chop up this target DNA or RNA, but also a reporter or a signal that's introduced into the sample. And so it's actually the quantification of cleavage of this reporter construct that we are quantifying. But the power really lies in the fact that the enzyme only switches on if the pathogen is present. So it acts very specifically so you don't get false positives.
Okay, so by false positives, you mean you don't get a positive result on the test, but the person doesn't actually have the disease.
Exactly, yes.
So why is it so important, Shivani, then, that this kind of technology is coming into existence? Because at the moment, if people go and get a test for, let's say, syphilis or chlamydia, gonorrhea, they might be waiting for days before they get their result. How could this change the game, this kind of testing?
Yeah, so we're really excited because the test can be performed in under an hour. So what that really means and what we're hoping for, you know, the
dream.
The dream, exactly, thanks, is that an individual can come into the clinic, get their test performed and be treated in the same visit. Because what we're finding with STIs in particular is that we have what's known as loss to follow-up. So a person comes in for their test, but then they have to come in again to get the result and get treated. And in that period, there's multiple barriers. There's time happening. There's life happening. So I know myself, I have blood tests waiting for me to go back to the GP to get the results. So we're hoping that by being able to perform the test quickly, where the patient is visiting the clinician, we're helping both patient get actionable outcomes quickly, as well as the clinician having extra tools to inform their clinical decision making.
How reliable is this new method compared to the traditional testing that happens in a lab and can take days to come back to you?
Short answer is it doesn't perform as strongly as a lab-based test yet. Its sensitivity, when we compared it to the gold standard testing, sits between 80 and 90%, which is really strong. And then for specificity, so this false positives I was talking about, we're sitting above 95% when we compare our test to the gold standard. What I should mention is that the technologies are fundamentally quite different. And so what we are hoping for is by having both these methods, so the golden standard and ours, we'll have a really complementary diagnostic pathway. So the fundamental difference I take for syphilis, for example, for syphilis testing, you have to have intravenous blood collection by a clinician or nurse. And then the test is a serological test. So what that means is you're measuring like the human response to infection. So it's known as an indirect test. What our technology is known as direct diagnostic test. So we are directly trying to find the pathogen DNA or RNA specifically. And as a result, it performs really strongly and you can have high confidence that when you have a positive result, you can treat.
So you're looking for the pathogen directly, the actual organism or evidence of it, as opposed to the body's immune system's response.
Exactly.
So this is portable though, suggesting that it might actually make a difference for people who are living in regional and remote places?
Yes, and that really has been our driving force because we know that there is a clear disparity or disproportional impact on Indigenous communities or those living in remote and rural regions because of the limited access to testing. So that was really the driving force for developing a portable test.
I know this isn't, Shivani, ready for being rolled out widely and it's not for large-scale development yet, but hopefully that's where it's headed. How much do we think a machine like this might cost? Because I'm just trying to get a sense of how easy it will be to roll this out to regional and remote places to get results for people more easily. What's the kind of cost of a machine like this proposed to be?
So I guess there's two things to consider. The machine itself, the portable device, which is essentially a heat block and a fluorescent reader, is an over-the-shelf manufactured product, manufactured all in Australia by a company named Axon. And they specialize in making affordable point-of-care devices. So whilst I won't put like a number on their device, that's for them, what I will say, it is significantly cheaper than instrument you would have in the lab.
Okay.
The actual assay, the CRISPR assay that we perform on the device is currently under $8. And that's before we have really optimized manufacturing and made it even cheaper. So I'm quite optimistic that it will be very affordable. And I guess the other power in our assay, which I hadn't mentioned, is right now, when you need to have a diagnostic test for, say, syphilis and herpes simplex virus, they actually require different tests with different technologies. But the power of our CRISPR tech is the targeting of multiple STIs in the single test. And why this is powerful is because different STIs present very similarly or you have co-infection. And so cases are being missed or misdiagnosed. And we hope that we'll be able to pick up those missed cases purely because we're testing for more than one infection.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that a clinician, a healthcare professional might only test someone for syphilis and not test them for HIV or gonorrhea, so it might get missed because the test wasn't requested, but your test would actually pick it up.
Yeah, I think typically gono and chlamydia, the co-infection rates are quite high, so those are the two pathogens you would test together. For syphilis, the growing literature is showing that because it presents with general ulcerations like herpes simplex virus and more recently Mpox, there is a bias towards thinking that it's herpes simplex virus just because it is more common and clinicians aren't really used to, you know, particularly for a GP, they're not used to seeing syphilis cases. But with the rise, we really need to be testing for, well, all three together.
Where's the swab taken from, Shivani?
We tested a variety of different swab types from genital and extragenital regions. We know that the gonorrhea and chlamydia assay performs much better using genital samples, so like urine samples. And for the syphilis and herpes simplex virus test, we typically use genital swabs.
So Shivani, you're saying that cost isn't a barrier to this and that it could actually be rolled out. What are the next steps? What are we waiting for?
So till now, our evaluation has been on clinical samples within the lab, so residual diagnostic clinical samples. The next stage is really to take our portable device into clinics, both high resource and low resource clinics. And we're really excited about this step because we're going to test how user-friendly it is, how impactful it is in getting results at an urban clinic, so at Melbourne Sexual Health Centre, as well as a low-resource clinic, and that's Clinic 34 in Darwin.
Dr. Shivani Pasricha from the Doherty Institute.
And you're listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National. So what's in the mailbag?
So the first email is my favourite, and I'm really glad that we're mentioning
it. All-time favourite or just favourite for this week?
Possibly, because Jason has written in, regarding a story we did last week on pain relief in children and what was effective, and part of the story was ibuprofen, an anti-inflammatory, and Jason has written in and said, I had to chortle at Norman moaning bloody Australians at Priya's pronunciation of ibuprofen. As a man in his mid-50s living in the UK and for the last 20 in Scotland, I've never heard anyone ever say it other than the same way Priya does. Cheers, Jason, in the Scottish Borders.
Oh, that explains it. He's almost English. He was in the Scottish Borders. Well, you have now, because it's ibuprofen.
It's not, though. Even my children went, what is Norman saying? And they're only 10 and 6, Norman, 9 and 6, actually.
Really?
Yes. Even they thought you were incorrect, and they're fans of Norman, so there you go.
Wow. Okay.
You made a comment about drinking warm orange juice, and we were really hoping that dentists would write in, but in fact we've had an industrial cleaning expert instead.
So what does Neil, the industrial cleaning expert, say?
Neil says lemons, limes and oranges all contain citric acid, which is very effective at removing calcium-based deposits, for example, water scaling inside pipes or the protective apatite layer in teeth. I use citric acid regularly in industrial chemical cleaning, and when the cleaning solution is heated, is more effective at removing calcium scale.
See? See?
Okay. We read on.
I can't pronounce ibuprofen, but I get it right here.
The general rule, this is fascinating. Thank you for writing in, Neil. The general rule is for every 10 degrees Celsius increase in temperature, the rate of reaction doubles. So heated lemon or orange juice, say to 60 degrees, from 20 degrees, which is around the same temperature most of us drink tea, will be 16 times more damaging on teeth. If you do drink hot juice, I would suggest that you would need to increase your oral hygiene to mitigate the increased damaging effects.
Or just have a cup of tea and forget the orange juice.
So I'm going to, sorry, I just need to know this. When you are unwell with a viral upper respiratory tract infection and your throat is sore, do you not have a warm lemon drink?
No, I have honey in tea. In large amounts, which probably is not that good for your teeth either.
What about your caffeine as well? Or herbal tea?
No, I think it's just a vehicle. I don't think it's the tea, but I think it's the honey. And honey does have antimicrobial effects. So I have honey. I do not have citrus. I mean, why are you taking the citrus? It's not got any effect.
No, well, that's what Indians do. We have warm lemon, honey, ginger. That's just part and parcel. I will not be ceasing because of my teeth.
I'd have ginger.
No, okay. This is interesting. Anyway, write in if you'd like to,
so
friends.
You are immune to evidence. I mean, here's Neil.
I'm not immune.
An industrial cleaning expert giving us his...
Norman Swan, I'm not immune to evidence. I simply think that everyone should take things out of their toolbox that applies to their life.
Okay.
We can't apply it all. I will drink the hot lemon drink. Imagine if my mother made it or my grandmother and I didn't drink it.
I know.
It's not worth it, my friend. It's not worth it.
Okay.
Jane has written in. Jane says, hi, Norman and Priya, and this letter is in response to a story we did last week on vaccine reminders, SMS reminders for parents to try and get kids vaccinated in a timely fashion. She says, would you like to read this one, Norman?
Sure. In your podcast discussion of immunisation reminders, it didn't mention the fact that the government sends reminders to parents of children due for immunisation as their family government funding is tied to it. My daughter recently received a reminder for her three-month-old saying there was a certain time frame for his immunisation to be received, after which she would receive no further funding. Further, children who are not immunised are not free to be enrolled in preschool, long daycare or family daycare, as the government has no jab, no play rule, unless a recognised medical exemption exists. Surely all of these add up to the government taking responsibility as much as they can for keeping immunisation rates as high as they can. Does a text from their GP add a further incentive?
May I answer this? Because...
You may.
The government does send reminder letters, but they are usually snail mail. They're usually in your letterbox. And a lot of people do not either A, check their letterbox or update their details. So I think the SMS is a very important second safety net.
And there's room for a positive message rather than necessarily saying you're not going to get your benefits if you don't have your child immunised. Although that does increase the immunisation rate, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, nice to get a positive message.
Yes. We love hearing from you. And if you would like to add what you have when you have a sore throat, is it hot citrus or not? Honestly, we'll probably read the letter out. Just write to healthreport@abc.net.au.
And don't forget our sister podcast, What's That Rash, where this week we're talking about the benefits or not of snail snot.
Oh, alliteration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not really snot, but it's snail slime.
Yes. Look, I'm into skincare, but I'm probably going to leave this one, even if there's robust evidence.
See you next week.
See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.